Welcome to Scarlet Tavern. Grab a drink, take a seat, and let's begin. Today, we're kicking off a four-part series on a case that's as cryptic as it is chilling, the Zodiac Killer. Think of it like a real-life game of Clue, but with fewer candlesticks and way more terrifying ciphers. Was it the anonymous letter writer by the lake, the masked stranger in the theater, or just someone who really hated detectives? Buckle up, sleuths, this mystery starts off strange, get stranger, and spoiler alert, it's still unsolved. Let the puzzle pieces fall where they may. This is Scarlet Tavern. All right, so we are four-part on the Zodiac Killer. This Zodiac Killer will be wrapping up our season, and then we will come back in January with some reruns with better quality and sometimes new information. So
no, you've been eager to get into this case, kind of like, yes, I was with Jack the Ripper.
So Zodiac Killer is one of my favorites, simply because when I was younger, they came out with a Zodiac Killer movie called The Zodiac. My dad took me to see it in theaters when I was little, and it was like a 4-hour movie. They played like 2 hours, you had a break, and then they played another 2 hours. It was kind of a documentary, but it was also like there were actors. So
yeah. Robert Downey Jr. and Jake Gyllenhaal. Yeah, and I think Brie Larson.
Great movie. It's great. It's just super, super long. But that really got me interested at like 8 years old in the Zodiac Killer.
I still question your dad taking you to see that age. I mean, my
dad was a cop. I come from a law enforcement family.
Still.
It's a big thing. So I've always been fascinated by the Zodiac Killer and fascinated that they still have no idea who did it. So this will be, again, four parts and kind of break it down. And then at the end, we'll give, again, our ideas on what we think, who we think it may be, and things like that, because there's tons of speculations of who it may be.
This is very much similar, not in the MO or anything, but just in the amount of like Jack the Ripper, where there's just so many theories, and this is just strictly now in the realm of amateur sleuths, almost like us, and just the amount of theories who did it.
Yeah, so. Between 1968 and 1969, a shadowy figure emerged in Northern California, terrorizing the region with a series of brutal, seemingly random attacks. With a twisted sense of humor and a knack for taunting both the police and the public, the Zodiac Killer left behind a trail of bloodshed, cryptic letters, and mysterious ciphers that, to this day, have never been fully deciphered. But this isn't just a tale of a murderer on the loose. The Zodiac case stands as a perplexing puzzle, a web of codes, symbols, and psychological manipulation that lingers unsolved more than 50 years later. Who was this elusive predator? What motivated his spree of violence and cruelty? And most hauntingly, why was he never caught? Over the next four episodes, we'll dissect the Zodiac's crimes in excruciating detail, analyze his letters and ciphers, and delve into the minds of the investigators who spent their careers chasing a ghost. We'll explore the psychological profile of a killer who seemed to revel in his anonymity, taunting authorities with each new correspondence and leaving the world to wonder, is he still out there, lurking in the shadows? The story we're about to tell is not for the faint of heart. It's a narrative that involves terror, heartbreak, and the lasting impact on the victims and their families. This is the story of the Zodiac Killer, an enduring mystery that has captivated true crime enthusiasts, amateur sleuths, and hardened detectives for decades. So once again, pour yourself a drink, settle into your seat, and prepare to step back in time to an era where fear grips the San Francisco Bay Area and a nameless killer prowled the night. This is more than just a case file, it's a legend. A dark chapter in history that still raises more questions than answers. And it all begins with a fateful night on a lonely, winding road in 1968. Are you ready to confront the mystery? because the Zodiac is waiting. To truly understand the Zodiac's reign of terror, we need to step back into the late 1960s and early 1970s, a period of profound change, turmoil, and uncertainty in America. Northern California, where the Zodiac would make his mark, was a region at the epicenter of cultural shifts and societal upheaval. The Bay Area was a cauldron of contradictions. It was a place where free love and peace were championed into the sprawling counterculture movement. Yet beneath the surface, tensions simmered. The summer of love had come and gone in San Francisco's hot Ashbury district, leaving behind a fractured community dealing with disillusionment and an influx of crime. The idealistic dreams of harmony and unity were unraveling, replaced by a growing sense of discontent and anxiety.
I wouldn't go to San Francisco nowadays, but I have always been interested in seeing the Haight-Ashbury area. There is so much of classic rock and roll history there.
Yeah.
Like the you can still actually go into the houses like where The Who, Janis Joplin, The Grateful Dead, all of those guys were like neighbors at one point living in San Francisco.
Nationally, the Vietnam War was a contentious issue dividing families and friends. Anti-war protests became a regular occurrence, drawing massive crowds and sometimes ending in violence. Young people were rebelling against the establishment, challenging the values and norms of the older generations. The nation was grappling with questions of identity, morality, and purpose. And this sense of disorientation and conflict was mirrored in the streets of San Francisco, Vallejo, and Napa, the Zodiac's hunting grounds. In the world of crime, notorious figures like Charles Manson and his family dominated headlines after the grisly Tate LaBianca murders in 1969. Fear of senseless violence was spreading across California, and in its wake came a deep mistrust of outsiders and a constant feeling of being watched.
That's an episode we're going to get into, probably maybe not next season, but the season four. The Charles Manson murders. Yep.
And yet, for many, the Zodiac's entrance into this chaotic landscape felt like something more insidious. Unlike Manson's brutal cult killings or the commonplace crimes of the era, the Zodiac's murders had a chilling, almost performative quality. There was no clear motive, no discernible pattern beyond random acts of violence, and no apparent connection between the victims. He wasn't just taking lives, he was playing a game. One where he controlled the rules, the pieces, and the players. Compounding this atmosphere of unease was the growing obsession with serial killers. Just a few years earlier, the term serial killer hadn't even entered the lexicon. It was law enforcement's struggle to define the Zodiac and others like him, men who kill not out of passion or necessity, but for pleasure or infamy, that led to the birth of a new kind of predator in the public's mind. With each letter the Zodiac penned to local newspapers, he tightened his grip on the Bay Area's collective psyche. He relished in making the police and the public dance to his tune. He didn't just want to kill. He wanted people to know about it. He craved the fear he inspired, the headlines he generated, and the twisted fame that came with being a faceless monster among unsuspecting crowds. But why California? Why now? The state, known for its laid-back lifestyle and sun-drenched coastlines, was rapidly transforming into a breeding ground for modern nightmares. From the unsettling disappearances of women in Santa Rosa to the famous Highway 101 Strangler, Northern California was earning a dark reputation. It was a place where the promise of new beginnings could just as easily turn into the terror of unknown endings. Highway 101 Strangler is one that we're going to do too. Yet amidst the chaos, there was still hope. The California dream, with its promise of freedom and opportunity, persisted. People still flocked to the Golden State in search of a better life, blissfully unaware that a shadow lurked in the background, a shadow that called itself the Zodiac. As the body count began to rise, so did the paranoia. Couples who once ventured out on late-night drives or parked on secluded Lover's Lane now found themselves looking over their shoulders. They weren't just worried about being mugged or harassed. They feared a masked figure who seemed to strike at random, leaving behind cryptic messages and symbols that defied understanding. This was the world the Zodiac stalked, a world caught between the idealism of the past and the harsh realities of a dangerous present. A world where people still believed in peace and love, even as a killer mocked them from the shadows. Tonight, we journey into that fractured world. The Zodiac Killer was more than just a murderer. He was a mirror reflecting the anxieties, contradictions, and hidden darknesses of his time. And as we delve into his crimes, his letters, and the painstaking investigation that followed, we'll see just how deeply his legacy has penetrated the fabric of American culture. Welcome to California in the late 1960s, where hope and horror walked hand in hand, and the Zodiac was about to make his presence known.
I mean, we could make a whole show just based off the unsolved crimes of California in the 60s and 70s, and just even the ones that they did solve. It was a rough time.
Now, to unravel the enigma of the Zodiac Killer, we must start with a detailed look at the crimes that established his terrifying legacy. These murders were not just random acts of violence. They were meticulously planned, almost ritualistic, and each seemed to serve as a message to law enforcement and the public. The timeline of confirmed Zodiac attacks spanned less than a year, yet the ripples of fear and confusion lingered long after the killing stopped. And that's what makes the Zodiac so unique, is typically serial killers kill over years, 3, 4, 5, 6 years. All of the Zodiac's kills were within 1 year.
That's crazy.
That's it.
Almost seems more akin to a spree killing more than a, like you said, like a serial killing.
But the difference is a spree killer doesn't taunt the police. They don't leave cryptic messages. That's what makes him a serial killer, not a spree killer.
Yeah.
Is because he was taunting them. He was admitting that he did these things. They just could never catch him. And some people, and we'll talk about it later, people believe he had an IQ that was off the charts.
Oh, it's possible.
With being able to do all this cryptography. Even the top cryptologists in the world have never been able to figure this out. Number one, we don't have the key to the cipher.
So
that's the hardest thing. Nobody could figure out what the key was.
I mean, it could be anything.
Who knows if he didn't even make up his own key?
Well, usually, I mean, he could have, but typically somebody like this would have used a book or something like that to be a key. We don't know. It would be hard to tell unless we knew who the person was. And then we could figure it out. Like, okay, now that we know who this is, what's his favorite book? What is he checking out of the library? Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. But so there's none of that in this case. Nope. Like that's what's scary, is that there's no evidence whatsoever.
I mean, for all we know, this guy could still be alive.
Oh, I think they actually, if I remember correctly, I read something about it, just a thing in passing. They said that years later, when the FBI made, someone in the FBI or a former agent made a profile, at this point, given the age he would have been in, he'd be dead by now. He would have been dead by the, well, I don't want to say the 80s, but he would have been, now he's dead. He's got to be. He would have aged out and probably died, unless he was like a little kid when he started killing people.
I mean,
he could have been a teenager. He could have been someone in his early to mid-20s.
Even if he was in his 20s in 1968, that's still, I mean,
unless he got drafted into Nam.
I mean, that's not, and that could be why he stopped killing.
Yeah.
But he could very well be alive. It's stupid of them to say he's not, because we don't know who it is. We don't know how old he was. Your profiles aren't always right, especially at this time.
Oh, they would have been.
Profiles didn't exist.
Yeah, they hadn't.
They didn't even coin the term serial killer at this point. They didn't coin this term serial killer until like 72 or 73. So, which again, go watch Mindhunters.
Great show.
It's supposed to be getting renewed. So watch it. Great show. It's amazing. It is. They picked the perfect people to play all of the serial killers. Okay. So
with the term serial killer, they don't have the exact origin of the term, is not known, but it appears to have come into use in law enforcement circles in the 1970s. And more commonly in society in the 1980s and 1990s.
Yeah. Well, we know where it came from, because the FBI agent that did it was, they literally made a show about him.
Mm-hmm.
So he is the one that has coined the term serial killer, and it was like 72, 73. So, Lake Herman Road, December 20th, 1968. The story begins on a cold, dark December night in 1968. It was 2 days before Christmas, and 17-year-old David Faraday had planned a special date with his girlfriend, 16-year-old Betty Lou Jensen. It was their first official date, and the couple had planned to attend a Christmas concert at Hogan High School. After the concert, they decided to go for a drive along Lake Herman Road, a rural stretch near Vallejo, California, a well-known lover's lane where couples often went to seek privacy. At approximately 10:15 p.m., David parked his mother's Rambler in a small gravel turnout on Lake Herman Road, a secluded spot with a view of the countryside. Moments later, another vehicle pulled up nearby, and what happened next would mark the beginning of a horrific series of events. The assailant, described by investigators as a lone individual, approached the couple's car. It is believed that he either ordered them out of the vehicle or fired a warning shot to scare them. The killer then shot David Faraday in the head at point-blank range as he exited the car, killing him instantly. Betty Lou Jensen, panicked and terrified, fled from the vehicle. The killer pursued her and shot her 5 times in the back as she tried to run for her life. Her body was found lying 28 feet from the car. There was no clear motive, no signs of robbery, no sexual assault, and no obvious connection between the victims and the killer. The randomness of the crime perplexed investigators and set the stage for the nightmares to come.
That has...
You see why they were so confused.
5 shots when she's running. That means he could have been proficient with firearms.
Or he just was a faster runner than her. She probably wasn't... Yeah, she probably wasn't geared up. They just came from a concert, so she was probably in nicer clothing. So it's not like she was in like running shoes. So she probably didn't get far, and he was able to get close enough. Bang, 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 bang.
Yeah, but a moving target. We've all had the stress exercises in the military when we were at the shooting range.
We're also assuming he's stressed. He may not even be stressed.
Blue Rock Springs. July 4th, 1969. The next attack came on a festive night meant for celebration.
Wait a minute. January, February, March, April, May, June. 7 months later? Yeah. Wow. Yeah, okay.
It was Independence Day, and 22-year-old Darlene Farron, a married woman and mother, had decided to spend the evening with a friend, 19-year-old Michael Magal. The two drove to Blue Rock Springs Park, another popular spot for couples near Vallejo, less than 4 miles from the site of the first murders. At approximately midnight, Darlene picked her 1963 Chevy Corvair, parked her 1963 Chevy Corvair in a secluded area. Only minutes later, another vehicle, believed to be a light-colored sedan, pulled in and parked beside them. The car left momentarily, then returned, pulling up behind them and effectively blocking their escape. The driver, a heavy-set man with a round face and curly hair, stepped out and approached Darlene's side of the car. Without a word, he shone a flashlight into their eyes, temporarily blinding them, and then opened fire with a 9mm semi-automatic pistol. He fired 5 shots through the window, hitting both Darlene and Michael multiple times. The killer started to walk back to his vehicle, but hearing Michael's cries of pain, he returned and fired 2 more shots into each victim before finally driving away. Darlene Farron was killed instantly, but miraculously, Michael Magal survived. Despite his severe injuries, he was able to provide a description of the assailant, although it was vague. Less than an hour after the attack, the Vallejo Police Department received a chilling phone call. The killer calmly stated, "I want to report a double murder. If you will go 1 mile east on Columbus Parkway to the public park, you will find the kids in a brown car. They were shot with a 9mm Luger. I also killed those kids last year. Goodbye." I want to say that that's what the voice sounded like. The call was traced to a phone booth near a gas station only a few blocks from the Vallejo Police Department, but the caller was gone by the time officers arrived. The confession marks the Zodiac's first direct contact with authorities, and with it, he claimed responsibility for the Lake Herman Road murders linking the two crimes.
About to say, I would imagine the police probably would have been a little taken aback. I mean, 7 months later, like, what murders? Kids? Oh, crap. Yeah, those.
Yep.
Okay, I can't imagine. I would imagine that for the Herman Road murders would have been cold from the get-go. I mean, literally, he literally just randomly shows up, boom, boom, they all dead, and that's it, gone. And forensics were not a thing back then, so.
Well, they had forensics. It's just not as sophisticated as it is now.
So, on a sunny Saturday afternoon in late September, college students Brian Hartnell and Cecilia Shepherd decide to spend the day relaxing by the shores of Lake Berryessa, a picturesque spot in Napa County, about 25 miles north of Vallejo. The couple picnicked on a small peninsula that jutted out into the lake, enjoying the tranquil surroundings. As they lay on a blanket, talking and admiring the scenery, neither noticed a man lurking in the background watching them. This figure eventually emerged from the woods wearing a bizarre costume, a black hood that covered his head and shoulders and a large pair of sunglasses. Emblazoned on his chest was a symbol that would soon become synonymous with terror, a white crosshair within a circle. He approached the couple, brandishing a .45 caliber handgun, and told them he had just escaped from a prison and needed money and their car keys to make his getaway. He spoke calmly, giving no indication of the horror that would follow. The couple complied, handing over what little cash they had and the car keys. But then the man produced pre-cut lengths of rope and ordered Cecilia to bind Brian's hands and feet before tying herself up. With the couple helpless on the ground, the killer suddenly pulled out a long knife and began to stab them repeatedly. 6 times for Brian and 10 times for Cecilia. He then walked calmly back to Brian's car and used a black felt-tip pen to write on the car door, Vallejo, /12/20/68/7/4/69/September 27/69/6:30/by knife. Then the killer disappeared into the woods, leaving his victims bleeding and helpless. Despite the severity of their injuries, Brian Hartnell survived and later provided a detailed account of the attack, including the killer's voice, which he described as monotone and emotionless. Cecilia Shepherd, however, succumbed to her injuries 2 days later. Once again, a call was made to the police. At 7:40 p.m., the Napa County Sheriff's Office received a report from a man claiming responsibility for the crime. His voice was calm and deliberate as he stated, "I want to report a murder. No, a double murder. They are 2 miles north of park headquarters. They were in a white Volkswagen Karmann Ghia." The call was traced to a phone booth in downtown Napa, but the killer was gone by the time officers arrived.
So it seems like, yes, he's killing them, but why not make sure that the guy's dead too?
Because that's not the thrill. Thrill is the act.
The only reason, I guarantee you, though, if he, with the second murder, was it David Montague? McGow. If he had not made a sound before he left, probably would have lived. Because like you said.
He did live. He did live.
I meant Darlene would have lived.
No, she was dead.
I thought she also survived.
No, she was dead immediately.
Okay. So, but he probably wouldn't have come back because like you said, the thrill was the action.
He doesn't care if they die or not.
He's just assuming they die because the second murder and this one, he's literally saying that's a double murder, even though not even realizing that they're actually dead. He just stabbed them.
But like, that also tells you that he doesn't stick around and watch.
Yeah.
He just leaves. So the thrill isn't in death. The thrill is in the act of killing or maiming. Less than 2 weeks later, the Zodiac struck again, this time choosing an unlikely victim and location. In the affluent Presidio Heights neighborhood of San Francisco, cab driver Paul Stein was murdered in his own taxi. On the night of October 11th, Paul Stein picked up a passenger at the intersection of Mason and Geary Streets. The fare requested to be driven to the corner of Washington and Maple Streets, but for reasons unknown. Stein drove one block past the destination to Washington and Cherry Streets. At around 9:55 p.m., witnesses saw the passenger lean forward and shoot Stein in the head at point-blank range with a 9mm handgun. The killer then exited the vehicle, walked around to the driver's side, and carefully tore a piece of Stein's blood-soaked shirt. He wiped down parts of the car with a cloth to remove any fingerprints and walked away into the night. Three teenagers across the street witnessed the attack and called the police. They described the suspect as a white male, approximately 35 to 45 years old, with a stocky build and reddish-brown crew-cut hair. The police arrived on the scene within minutes, but due to a miscommunication, officers were told to look for a black suspect. By the time the mistake was corrected, the killer had vanished. 2 days later, the San Francisco Chronicle received a letter from the Zodiac. Enclosed within the letter was a piece of Paul Stein's shirt, proving beyond doubt that the Zodiac had been responsible. In the letter, the Zodiac mocked the police, stating, "School children make nice targets. I think I shall wipe out a school bus some morning. Just shoot out the front tire and pick off the kiddies as they come bouncing out." The single letter plunged San Francisco into a panic. Parents kept their children home, police escorted buses, and the Zodiac's legend grew. No longer was he just a murderer of couples. It expanded his targets and made it clear that no one was safe.
Seems like he's escalating his mode of attention. He kills the first couple at the Lake Road. He waits 7 months. Nothing happens. Probably because the police showed up and they had nothing to go on, so they just either attributed it to some kind of other crime gone wrong, or just probably what the go-to thing was, random hitchhiker walks along, kills him, and then keeps going. Then he does it again. This time he calls in and says, "I did it, and I did those kids last year." He's also wanting the attention, and he's just building up on it. I think the thrill is also just the attention. And
every serial killer wants the attention.
But I think, honestly, it's also he wasn't getting it, so he keeps escalating. So because nobody is paying attention to him, so now he's doing, like, he makes threats. "I'm going to kill this whole school bus of kids." Probably wouldn't have done it because obviously he didn't do it.
After the murder of Paul Stein, the Zodiac killer's confirmed attacks abruptly ceased. He continued to taunt law enforcement and the public for years with more letters and ciphers. Some researchers believe that there may have been additional victims, but none have been definitively linked to the Zodiac. From December 1968 to October 1969, a span of less than a year, the Zodiac killer took the lives of 5 confirmed victims and left 2 others severely wounded. He established himself as a sadistic, calculating murderer who craved the spotlight and reveled in the fear he inspired. As we move forward, we'll dive deeper into the contents of his letters and the codes he sent, the psychological game he played with those who sought to bring him justice. Now, the Zodiac Killer's violent crimes were terrifying enough on their own, but it was his letters and ciphers that truly cemented his place as one of America's most infamous serial killers. These written communications were far more than the rantings of a madman. They were calculated, taunting, and brimming with arrogance. Each letter offered a glimpse into the psyche of a predator who craved recognition and control. The Zodiac wasn't content to simply kill. He wanted the world to know that he was smarter than everyone trying to catch him. Over the course of his reign of terror, the Zodiac sent over 20 letters to local newspapers, law enforcement agencies, and even private citizens. He attached ciphers filled with cryptic symbols, claimed responsibility for murders both confirmed and unconfirmed, and made chilling threats. He addressed his letters to the editor, signed them with his distinctive crosshair symbol, and frequently opened with a greeting that seemed almost polite. "This is the Zodiac speaking." Tonight we'll unravel the Zodiac's communications piece by piece, starting with his first known letter and the ciphers that have kept cryptographers and law enforcement baffled for decades. The Zodiac's introduction to the world came in the form of 3 nearly identical letters, all sent on the same day to 3 different newspapers, the Vallejo Times Herald, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the San Francisco Examiner, with the Chronicle being the most famous.
I believe the Chronicle is still around, but I don't think the Examiner is.
No, Chronicle is still around. Chronicle is the one that has covered almost every serial killer that has happened in California. Each letter was written in block capital letters with no punctuation, and all were postmarked July 31st, 1969. The letters began with a chilling confession. I am the killer of the two teenagers last Christmas at Lake Herman. Each letter provided details about the Lake Herman Road murders and the Blue Rock Springs attack, details that only the killer would know. But the Zodiac's letters didn't stop at merely confessing. Each letter contained one third of a cipher, which he demanded be published on the front page of each newspaper. The Zodiac promised that the cipher, when solved, would reveal his identity. The cryptic note closed with an ultimatum. If the newspapers refused to publish his ciphers, he would cruise around all weekend killing lone people in the night, then move on to kill again until I end up with a dozen people over the weekend. Faced with such a terrifying threat, the newspapers complied, and the cryptic symbols filled their pages the next day. The 408 symbol cipher, as it came to be known, was split into three parts and appeared in print on August 1st, 1969.
Jeez. Starting to get an idea of what this kind of... Again, I've briefly read on it, but I don't know anything. I can guarantee you, whoever this Zodiac killer was when he was growing up, before he did this, this is a guy who's been bullied, henpecked, and pushed around his life. Because everything is screaming of, I'm smarter than you, you don't know how smart I am, look at me now, kind of thing. Because I guarantee you, you said it, and other people said it, this guy is probably genius level, but you would never know it. If you saw him, you'd never know it. He would just be some, like, whatever.
He was probably some data analyst or something like that.
Probably the lowest menial job you could find that gave him no...
There's some people that believe he was a teacher.
I don't think I agree with that, because that's still a intellectual... Why? Well, mostly because I feel like this is somebody who is not... Whatever his thing before this, he is not being intellectually stimulated. There's no...
Teaching kids is not intellectually... is.
I mean, it depends on what he... If he is a teacher, it depends on what he is. He had to be almost like a PE teacher.
But if you think, if he's a genius and he's teaching school in California...
I mean,
especially in San Francisco, in the 60s, the kids were not smart.
No, an argument could be made the kids aren't smart these days either, but I don't know. I feel like this guy would probably, like you said, would just be like a data analyst, probably someone who gives him a sheet every day. It's like, here, Mike, type this up. And that's the extent of what he does.
So, despite the Zodiac's promise that the cipher would reveal his identity, the solution provided no such information. The code was cracked just 1 week later by a high school teacher named Donald Hardin and his wife, Betty. The decoded message read as follows. I like killing people because it's so much fun. It is more fun than killing wild game in the forest because man is the most dangerous animal of all. To kill something gives me the most thrilling experience. It is even better than getting your rocks off with a girl. The best part of it is that when I die, I will be reborn in paradise, and those I have killed will become my slaves. I will not give you my name because you will try to slow down or stop my collecting of slaves for my afterlife. The content of the cipher was shocking. It revealed a mind that found pleasure in the act of murder and viewed it as a game, a hunt. The reference to being reborn in paradise hinted at some warped belief system or fantasy world the Zodiac had constructed for himself. But true to his word, the Zodiac did not provide his name. Instead, he signed the cipher with a symbol, a crosshair inside of a circle. So it almost, I believe this man was well educated as well, because that being reborn in paradise makes me think of Islam. Paradise after in the afterlife, so maybe he took from that and had a twisted view of it,
or reincarnation from
Buddhism
and Hindu, right?
Yeah. So,
well, definitely San Francisco Bay Area, which also maybe tells me he's. I'm sure most people probably agree he was probably native to that area, because I mean he's able to go to the quote unquote lover's lane, so he probably knew kind of where the areas of where to go. I'm sure there's plenty of deserted roads along Northern California. They can't all be quote unquote lover's lane. So Yeah, I think he is definitely educated, but I think his education is very underutilized, and I would not be surprised if a lot of it is coming from just himself going to like the library and learning too.
The Zodiac didn't wait long to follow up. On August 4th, 1969, he sent another letter to the San Francisco Examiner. This time, he began the correspondence with a now infamous line. "Dear editor, this is the Zodiac speaking." It was the first time he used this moniker, and with it, he took on a persona, one that would define his legacy. In the letter, the Zodiac expressed frustration that law enforcement hadn't caught him yet, mocked the police's inability to solve his ciphers, and continued to taunt the public by claiming he'd be moving to new methods of collecting slaves. 2 months later, on October 13th, 1969, the San Francisco Chronicle received another letter. This one contained a piece of Paul Stein's bloodstained shirt removed from the scene of his murder in Presidio Heights. The letter was a direct taunt to the police, confirming that they were dealing with the same killer. Enclosed in this letter was a new cipher, this time with 340 symbols, known as the 340 cipher. It remained unsolved for over 50 years. For decades, cryptographers and enthusiasts tried to break it, but it wasn't until December 2020 that a team of private researchers finally cracked it. The decoded message read, "I hope you're having lots of fun in trying to catch me. That wasn't me on the TV show, which brings up a point about me. I'm not afraid of the gas chamber because it will send me to paradise all the sooner, because I now have enough slaves to work for me, where everyone else has nothing when they reach paradise, so they are afraid of death. I am not." The 340 cipher revealed little that was new. It echoed themes from his earlier letters, death, paradise, and a sense of superiority over those who feared dying. And yet it served as another reminder of Zodiac's intelligence and his enjoyment in keeping the public and law enforcement dancing to his tune.
I would imagine this guy is also probably very antisocial.
Oh, sure.
You could probably have been to work with Zodiac Killer. A, you would have never known it. And B, you probably would have been hard-pressed to even probably recognize this guy. Because he was just kind of there, but not there at the same time.
On November 9th, 1969, the Zodiac sent a 7-page letter to the San Francisco Chronicle. This letter detailed a sinister plan to plant a bomb on a school bus, rigging it to go off as the children were exiting. He provided a diagram of the device, complete with crude illustrations and descriptions of how it would work. The letter also contained a chilling statement. "School children make nice targets. I think I shall wipe out a school bus some morning. Just shoot out the front tire and pick off the kiddies as they come bouncing out." The letter sent parents into a panic. The city was gripped by fear, and law enforcement scrambled to increase protection around schools. Although the bomb was never built or used, it showcased the Zodiac's capacity to inspire fear even when he wasn't actively killing. Almost a year later, on October 27, 1970, the Zodiac sent what has become known as the Halloween card to San Francisco Chronicle reporter Paul Avery. Decorated with images of skeletons and Halloween phrases, this card included the number 14, a possible reference to the number of victims the Zodiac was claiming at that time. In this letter, the Zodiac attached another cipher, referred to as the "My Name Is" cipher, due to the possibility that it might reveal his name. The cipher, however, has never been definitively solved, and if it does contain the Zodiac's identity, it remains hidden to this day.
I bet you it doesn't even really, it's not his real name. It's probably a moniker of some kind.
It probably just says the Zodiac.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, this is a guy who is, he's just getting worked up. He wants to be caught because, like, all serial killers want to be caught because
they want the recognition.
Exactly, but at the same time, this is a guy who is just gleefully, like, he is reveling in it, so I doubt he ever put his real name
there. I think he gets off more on the fear than anything else.
Yes. Like I said, I think this is a guy who has been bullied, henpegged for most of his life, and something made him decide, this is what how I will take my revenge on the world.
You know what it's almost similar to, and what makes me think that he has some kind of twisted Islamic ties. Think about terrorism. It's all about instilling fear. I'm not saying he is a terrorist, but it's all about instilling fear. So most serial killers aren't about instilling fear. They're about the killing.
Yeah.
This guy's getting off on the fear just like terrorists do.
So, getting off of the fear of parents, like keeping their kids home from school because, hey, we don't know what bus is going to be bombed.
I would also, I'll even go so far. I bet you any money he came from an abused household. Probably, no, think about it. He's probably, the fear is like you said, the fear is there. It's what he's getting off of. Fear was used against him. Now he uses the fear to get him off. I would imagine he may have been from an abused household because, like, he obviously knows about hunting. He would probably, because he said, this gets me off better hunting humans than it does game. So he's probably familiar with hunting animals. So probably, I would imagine he learned some of his hunting instincts from being, you know, maybe his shitty dad took him out hunting or forced him to go hunting.
I mean, it's interesting because we look at terrorists now, and they were a little bit different in the 60s. A lot of them were politically motivated. But the big one that would fall into this is Al-Fatah. Yeah, it was the PFLP, the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine. They were a Palestinian movement that targeted civilians.
In the United States?
They had some, yeah. But you also had the Weather Underground, but that was mostly political.
Yeah, those guys were...
They were Democrats.
And
you had the IRA, the Tamil Tigers, obviously the KKK, Japanese Red Army, all of those. But yeah, so... The Zodiac's last confirmed letter was sent in 1974, more than 4 years after his confirmed murders had ceased. He had continued to write intermittently, each letter growing more erratic and less coherent. In these final correspondences, the Zodiac claimed credit for various events, including the abduction of a school bus full of children in Cowchilla, California, though the claim was never verified. After 1974, the letters abruptly stopped, and the Zodiac seemed to vanish from the public eye. Whether he was arrested for another crime, died, or simply lost interest, no one knows. What we do know is that his legacy of fear and mystery lived on through the letters and ciphers.
I don't think he lost interest.
No, I think he got dementia, personally.
I think he died.
I think he may be dead now. I don't think he died then. I think he got dementia. If you look, the letters that he was still sending got more erratic and less coherent, which is Alzheimer's or dementia. It means he still has the urge to do this, but he's not going to make as much sense.
Or he was having a mental unraveling from the fact that after a while, I believe by 1974, it was pretty clear the police were not making any headway into finding out who did it. I think, you know, it's possible he may have killed himself.
Yeah. Well, no. He wouldn't have killed himself.
Oh, well, probably. That
is not in his profile. He would not have killed himself. And if he did, he would have done it publicly so that his name could be out there. He's all about being known. If he killed himself, we would have known about it. He would have made it a public spectacle. Yes. You would have found his body hanging somewhere with the symbol painted on the door.
Maybe. So. I mean, I think the likelihood of suicide is very low, mostly because, like you said, he wants the attention. The only reason I could see suicide is if in his mental breaking, maybe he realized, no, nothing I do will keep this infamy going, because eventually the newspapers are gonna be like, okay, move on to a new news cycle or something, and he fades in the background, and no matter how many people he kills or whatever, it just won't be enough, and he just decides to chuck it in. But yeah, again,
there's no way he killed himself. Because again, he's all about the infamy, and the one last hurrah would be that somebody would have found his body with the symbol and a letter saying, "I am the Zodiac. You couldn't find me in time," and he'd be dead. So I don't think he killed himself. I think he had some mental mental disorder and then finally checked out and died slowly. So the Zodiac Killer's letters and ciphers were a crucial part of his identity, a way to control the narrative and instill fear and challenge those who sought to unmask him. He positioned himself as both predator and puppeteer, a man who reveled in being untouchable and unknowable. And with each new letter, he solidified his place in history as a figure that would haunt California's collective memory for decades to come. As we close this chapter, we move from the chilling content of the Zodiac's letters to the hunt itself. In the next episode, we'll delve more into the police investigation, the suspects, and the psychological profile of the Zodiac. So we're going to kind of jump into the media frenzy a little bit, and then part two will really pick up into it even more. So the Zodiac Killer's letters and gruesome murders shocked the public, but it was the media's coverage that turned the Zodiac into a household name. His haunting letters and cryptic ciphers were catnip for newspaper editors, who saw their circulation numbers skyrocket whenever they published a new communication from the elusive killer. But the media frenzy that ensued wasn't just about selling newspapers. It played right into the Zodiac's hands, giving him the platform and notoriety he so desperately craved. At a time when the fear of serial killers was spreading across the country, the Zodiac's ability to manipulate the press and law enforcement set him apart. He became a puppet master, pulling the strings and watching as police, journalists, and public danced to his tune. Every letter he sent became front-page news, and with each publication, the Zodiac grew more confident, more emboldened, and more dangerous. But his media attention was a double-edged sword. It both heightened awareness of his crimes and hindered the investigation, creating a complex web of competing interest, misinformation, and sheer terror. From the moment his first letters were published in August 1969, the Zodiac Killer was a media sensation. The editors of the Vallejo Times-Herald, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the San Francisco Examiner were faced with a terrifying decision: comply with the Zodiac's demands to print his letters and ciphers or risk provoking a potential massacre. Faced with such high stakes, the newspaper chose to comply, and soon the Zodiac's words were plastered across the front pages, capturing the public's attention and fueling a sense of fear and curiosity. Each new letter brought with it a fresh wave of anxiety. People eagerly picked up their morning papers, not to just catch up on the news, but to read the Zodiac's latest taunts, threats, and clues. His letters were written in a cold, detached manner, revealing a mind that was both calculating and cruel. The Zodiac seemed to relish in the chaos he created, mocking the police's inability to catch him and belittling the press for their role in spreading his fame. The media's role in this case became a source of contention. Some believe that by printing the Zodiac's letters and giving him the attention he sought, they were inadvertently encouraging him to continue his spree. Others argue that the public had the right to know, especially when the Zodiac was making direct threats against schools and specific individuals like San Francisco Chronicle reporter Paul Avery.
Yeah, I would be scared shitless if I'm right there and the serial killer targeted me.
Okay. One particular incident exemplified the Zodiac's relationship with the media. In October 1970, the Zodiac sent a Halloween card to Paul Avery, a reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle, who had been covering the case extensively. The card, decorated with creepy images of skeletons and an ominous message, "Peekaboo, you are doomed," put Avery on edge. The personal attack made headlines, and from then on, Avery carried a gun for protection, knowing that he could very well become the Zodiac's next victim. In response to the card, the Chronicle published a front-page story with the headline, "Zodiac sends reporter Halloween greeting." The article included the details of the threat and Avery's reaction. The public, fascinated and horrified, began referring to the growing obsession with the case as Zodiac Mania. The Halloween card incident had another unintended consequence. It spurred amateur sleuths into action. Letters flooded the Chronicle's office from readers claiming they had solved the ciphers or had identified the Zodiac. Some tips were serious, while others were nothing more than wild speculation. Law enforcement suddenly found itself sifting through a deluge of correspondence, much of it useless, while the Zodiac continued to watch and laugh from the shadows. While the media circus raged on, the police investigation faced its own set of challenges. The Zodiac case spanned multiple jurisdictions, Vallejo, Napa, San Francisco, and each jurisdiction had its own set of procedures, priorities, and limitations. Communication and cooperation between departments were inconsistent at best, and critical information was often lost or delayed due to bureaucratic red tape. The rivalry between police departments further complicated matters. Detectives in San Francisco didn't always share leads with those in Vallejo, and the Napa County Sheriff's Office Department often felt sidelined. The lack of collaboration allowed the Zodiac to slip through the cracks time and time again, escaping capture and continuing to elude justice. One of the most glaring examples of this lack of coordination occurred after the murder of Paul Stein. Witnesses reported seeing the suspects walking away from the crime scene, yet a mix-up in the police dispatch led responding officers to look for a black male instead of a black male suspect instead of a white male. As a result, the officers reportedly stopped and spoke to the Zodiac just blocks from the murder site, but let him go. By the time the mistakes were corrected, the killer had vanished into the night.
Oh, God.
Yeah. That so was... they more than likely talked to the Zodiac and asked if they if he had seen anything, and they let him go.
Honestly, that's the detectives in the from Scotland Yard who handled the Ripper case years before after they had all retired and some on their deathbeds. They reporters asked them, like, "Do you think you came close?" Many of them said, "I'm confident we spoke to Jack at some point because we interviewed almost half of Whitechapel."
Yeah.
And I get the feeling like this is I'm seeing lots of parallels in this.
Where you have three different police departments that do not know how to play well together because they all want the recognition. I want to find the serial killer. So we're not going to share anything with anybody.
Well, and that's the genius of the Zodiac killer is the knowing. This is where people believe he had an intimate knowledge of law enforcement as well. He purposely killed in multiple jurisdictions.
Because I guarantee you how the dynamic went. San Francisco, being the larger department, probably tried to muscle in and say, "We're in charge." Vallejo fought back, and Napa, being at this point mostly just rural vineyards and everything, and just a sheriff, are probably looked at as like Barney Fife and, you know. Like,
oh, you don't know what you're doing.
Exactly. And probably ironically, the biggest clues are probably in Napa. I would bet you any money. It's so perfectly fits into this whole bumbling thing. I think Cade's right. I would not be surprised if he planned it that way.
Yeah, that's how I would have done it. I mean, change jurisdictions.
Now, I mean, nowadays this would never even have been a thing because the FBI.
Now the FBI takes over.
Exactly, they would have been
as soon as it. Well, and no, okay, so FBI wouldn't take over right away because it didn't cross state lines. It would take some time for them to get there. They would definitely have to connect. Now, once the first letter came in with him saying, "Oh, I committed all of the." Both of these, then yes, the FBI would be involved.
But back then in the late 60s, early 70s,
the FBI didn't get involved in this stuff.
Yeah, they would have been, the FBI, and especially the ones in the Bay Area, with, like you said, would have been checking down the Weathermen, Symbionese Liberation Army, all of the counterculture people, finding commies everywhere. Yeah. That's what they were still focusing on at this point. I mean, hell, they didn't even have a mafia task force at this point. And yet, in literally, like 10, 15 years prior to this, they caught like all the big time mafia bosses in one location at one point, and they still refused to even acknowledge it was existing. So I can't imagine they would have saw serial killers as like their priority.
So despite these challenges, the police did everything they could to track down the Zodiac. Dozens of detectives worked the case, including some of the best minds in the California law enforcement community. Investigators combed through hundreds of leads, interviewed potential suspects, and developed psychological profiles to try and understand what drove the Zodiac to kill. The FBI and California Department of Justice were eventually brought in to assist, and task forces were established to centralize the investigation. One such task force, led by the California DOJ, compiled a detailed suspect profile based on eyewitness reports, crime scene evidence, and the content of the Zodiac's letters. The profile painted a picture of a man who was highly intelligent, with a background in cryptography or an interest in codes and symbols. He was believed to be a lone wolf, socially awkward, and likely suffered from a deep sense of inadequacy and a need for control. The FBI's behavioral analysis unit suggested that the Zodiac's choice of victims, couples, lone drivers, and a cab driver, showed a preference for power and dominance. His communications indicated a profound need for attention and recognition, traits commonly seen in narcissistic and psychopathic individuals. Yet for all their profiling and evidence gathering, the police were always one step behind. Every promising lead turned into a dead end. Handwriting analysis, witness statements, and even fingerprints found on the letters led to inconclusive results. Every time they thought they were closing in, the Zodiac slipped away, leaving only more questions in his wake. One of the most prominent suspects was Arthur Leigh Allen, a convicted child molester and former schoolteacher. Allen matched the Zodiac's general physical description, had been in the vicinity of the murders, and owned a Zodiac brand wristwatch featuring the same crosshair symbol used by the killer. He also had a fascination with codes and ciphers. Despite these compelling pieces of circumstantial evidence, investigators could never definitively link Allen to the crimes. His handwriting did not match the Zodiac's, his fingerprints were not a match for those found on the letters, and there was no DNA evidence connecting him to the case. He was questioned multiple times, his home was searched, and yet no conclusive evidence ever surfaced to bring charges against him. He remained a person of interest until his death in 1992, but he was never officially charged. Numerous other suspects emerged over the years, including Rick Marshall, a projectionist with a background in electronics and cryptography, and Lawrence Kane, a man with a history of mental illness and violent behavior. But like Allen, no one has ever been definitively tied to the crimes. Each suspect had plausible connections, but none had the concrete evidence needed for the conviction. Now, the Zodiac case not only fueled a media frenzy and confounded law enforcement, but also had a lasting impact on the people of Northern California. Fear of the unknown gripped the region. Couples avoided lovers' lanes. School buses were escorted by police cars, and police began locking their doors at night, even in rural areas where they had once felt safe. The inability of the police to catch the Zodiac led to widespread frustration and distrust. Public pressure mounted on law enforcement to deliver results, but the killer seemed to vanish into thin air. Rumors spread that he might have been a member of law enforcement, or worse, that he was protected by someone within the system. With each new letter, the Zodiac killer reminded everyone that he was still out there, watching, waiting, and enjoying the spectacle. He reveled in the chaos he created, not just through his murders, but through his words. Words that would echo long after his physical presence disappeared. As we conclude this first episode, we leave behind the media frenzy and initial investigation to focus on the mind behind the mask. In the next episode, we'll delve deeper into the psychological profile of the Zodiac, the suspects who came under intense scrutiny, and the impact this case had on criminal profiling and forensic science. The Zodiac Killer story is far from over, and as we peel back the layers of this case, we'll find that every answer only leads to more questions.
This is creepy, especially like for a cop in a rural area. Cops locking their doors and people in rural areas especially locking their doors because they're scared. That is a lot.
I think would really scary about the Zodiac is the fact that there is a pattern, but at the same time there isn't a pattern. First you have the first murder, which was just his warm up act. Then you get to the second set of murders, or murder because the one guy lived. That's the big opening, and then it's just all of it is random, the randomness is the pattern, but at the same time it is random, and then this is what is so scary, because many other serial killers, you can be like, okay, well, I'm not a white blonde girl in my mid 20s, I'm okay, I don't have to worry about this. But in this case, anybody could have done it. I mean, for God's sakes, just a dude running a taxi in San Francisco got killed by it.
And I have my thoughts on who I think this is, but I want to save that for the very, very end. I've always had thoughts on not a specific person, but the kind of person who I think the Zodiac actually is, just based off of everything that I've studied and looked into. I think it kind of points to a very specific type of person. But yeah, so that wraps up episode one. We are going to have three more episodes to round this thing off, and then that will be our season finale. So we want to thank you for visiting the Scarlet Tavern. Please remember to turn in your glasses, push in your seat, and as always, tip the bard. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.